CNN Radio, I'm Paul Chambers. Kansas City police say they're pleased that the parents of a missing Missouri baby have resumed conversations with him. Captain Steve Young says so far leads in the case have not panned out.
Some of those tips, I have to admit, have been sightings of the child, and I know that they have proven those to be incorrect.
Young says the parents' involvement in the case is critical. The girl was last seen in her crib Monday night. Hundreds of homes and apartments in the area have been searched. A new hurricane has formed off Mexico's western coast, prompting forecasters to urge those in southwest Mexico to keep a close watch on its progress. John Cangelosi with the National Hurricane Center says there's also Tropical Storm Irwin.
Right now it's about almost 900 miles southwest of the southern tip of Baja California, like near Cabo San Lucas.
Irwin and Hurricane Hova could eventually make landfall in western Mexico. The Texas Rangers win the opening game of the American League Championship Series 3-2 over Detroit. Tigers manager Jim Leyland says two rain delays last night ruined it for his ace pitcher, Justin Verlander.
You know, this was a little bit of a weird night, obviously, with the rain the way it was.
Game two of the ALCS is tonight in Arlington. The National League Championship Series starts this afternoon. The rock band Weezer on its website says former bassist Mikey Welsh has died. He was with the band from 1998 through 2001. The site says Welsh's chapter in the Weezer story was vital, essential, wild, and amazing. CNN radio affiliate WGN reports Welsh's body was found Saturday afternoon in a Chicago hotel room. He was 40 years old. And pianist Roger Williams turned Born Free and many other songs into hits. He died this weekend in L.A. at 87. This is CNN Radio.
It's her first recital. Don't let the flu ruin it. Shield yourself with a quick and easy Rite Aid flu shot for just $27.99. They're covered by most insurance plans, available without an appointment, and come with a coupon book worth $100 in savings. So get your flu shot at any Rite Aid, anytime, and make sure you get that front row seat. That's the value of wellness. Quantities limited and available during pharmacy hours only. No purchase necessary for coupon book. See store for details or visit RiteAid.com/flu.
At Advance Auto Parts, we don't do anything just part way. We go full throttle. We won't just sell you a few cans of oil. Oh, no. We'll sell you a 5-plus quarts jug, a Valvoline conventional motor oil, and a Purelator classic oil filter. All for just $13.99 after $7 mail-in rebate. Think licking a stamp isn't worth $7? Well, go have another Chablis on your private yacht, money pants. Service is our best part.
Advance Auto Parts.
Free rebate price, $20.99. See store for details.
Hey, Lucas.
Hello, Angie. You ready for dinner?
Yeah. Hey, is that a new radio for your ride?
Sure is. Went to Walmart for the Pioneer DEH-44HD with HD radio built in.
HD radio?
HD radio is digital broadcast radio. Digital sound, new channels, no subscription fees.
From Walmart?
Great values there. Only $120 for a Pioneer HD radio receiver.
Forget dinner. Let's get my car and head to Walmart.
HD radio. More radio, more value. Now in the car audio department at Walmart.
Federal News Radio is a proud partner of FEA, the Federal Employees Education and Assistance Fund. In the past 25 years, FEA has helped more than 21,000 federal families with over $18 million in aid. By donating just $1 per pay period, you can help federal families keep the lights on, clean up after a natural disaster, or send a kid to college. Keep your CFC dollars in the federal family and make your pledge to FEA 11185 today. Learn more at FEA.org. That's FEEA.org.
Hi, this is Wayne Zell, host of Blueprint for Wealth every Saturday here on WFED at 10 a.m. Join me this week for my special guest, Ruth Ann Clark, Senior Market Director with Wells Fargo Bank Commercial Banking Sector. Blueprint for Wealth is brought to you by Odin, Feldman & Pittleman, a full-service law firm located in Fairfax, Virginia, serving the D.C. metro area. Visit us on the web at ofplaw.com.
If you are facing advanced illness or the end of life of a loved one, peace of mind is in short supply. Fortunately, pain-free comfort care is available from the Washington Home and Community Hospices, a not-for-profit organization with a holistic team of doctors, nurses, caregivers, social workers, chaplains, and volunteers. The team comes to you in your home or wherever you call home in D.C., Montgomery, or Prince George's County. For your peace of mind, call them day or night for a complimentary consultation at 866-234-7000.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles, and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired, entertained, and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions. And I'm joined by my co-hosts, David Taylor of the law firm Buchanan, Ingersoll & Rooney, and David Cooper of the Bank of America. And we have a fantastic lineup of guests for you today, including Robert Musselwhite, CEO of the Advisory Board Company, John Castellani, President and CEO of Pharma, Margaret Broad. Margaret's the head of school at St. Margaret's School. And lastly, Jim Bellis. Jim is the CEO and chairman of Diplomatic Language Services. But I'd like to introduce to you our first guest today. His name is Robert Musselwhite. Robert's the CEO of the Advisory Board Company. Welcome, Robert, and tell us, what is the Advisory Board Company?
Thanks. Great to be here. The Advisory Board Company is essentially, we help hospitals get better. We help hospitals perform better, help hospitals improve through a bunch of different ways, primarily through research and software products.
If I were walking into a hospital, what's one thing about my experience that has improved? Simply
sure.
Because of what you do.
You'll get better care, first and foremost, if you've walked into one of our member hospitals. Another example is, you might come in some hospitals, you might wait for a long time to see a doctor or to be treated in the ER. We work a lot on throughput and operational efficiency to help you. You might wait 2 minutes if you'd come into one of our hospitals.
And how do you guys do that?
We have a lot of people who know the industry very well and spend all their days researching best practices through the industry. So really our job is to surface best practices and help share those across different hospitals.
And how many hospitals do you do that for?
Work with close to 3,000 hospitals and health systems.
And the organization's been around for how long?
Organization's been around 30 years.
And you've been the CEO for how long?
CEO for 3 years.
Uh-huh. And they picked you as the absolute right guy. Why?
Always a hard question. When I came into the position, I think we were facing a new phase of our growth and a really changing healthcare environment. And I think I have a passion for strategic problem solving, and that's what we felt like we really wanted to focus on looking ahead at our growth strategy.
And where did the problem solving skills come from?
You know, I guess that's something I've enjoyed my whole life since I was a kid. I've always loved puzzles, mazes, games, and I've always loved complex math problems. So it's kind of me. I had a grandfather who now 99 years old, really the only grandparent I knew, and he used to send me puzzles and games. He lives in Europe, as always, Dutch originally, and sends puzzles and math problems through the mail that I'd always solve and send back to him. So I think it just started at a very young age.
So you were how young, and can you give us an example of a math problem? And we're not talking like Rubik's Cube here. We're talking what exactly?
Oh, I don't know. When you're a little kid, it's, you know, logic problems or mazes where, you know, you track the numbers through the maze and get out the other side. I mean, just, you know, crazy stuff. I think you liked making them, and it's always unique.
What about math problems fascinated you so?
I just liked the solving of the problem. So to me, it was there was an answer. So you could go through a logical thought process and come to an answer, generally.
And what does math have to do with swimming? Because you were a big-time swimmer, as I understand it.
I did a lot of swimming growing up. Swimming, there are probably some similarities just in terms of the rigor and the repetition of each that probably I like. There's a lot of also when you're swimming, swimming is a sport where you have mental time and you think while you're swimming. You get the ability to kind of noodle over things in your mind, and maybe there's a similarity to those thought processes.
So I'm not trying to be funny, but would you noodle over math problems? Or what were you thinking about when you were swimming? Because you seem like a thinker.
Well, I think growing up, life is just busy. You're in school, you're always doing homework, you have lots of activities. I did lots of different sports and stuff with friends, and I think swimming was always the time where you could spend time away from that and just think. Not math problems, but maybe reflecting on, you know, maybe some other types of problems, or just having time to kind of noodle on things that you might never have otherwise.
Tell us what happened freshman year in Princeton at the pool.
Well, it's so I was a swimmer in college, certainly not the best on the team by any stretch of the imagination, very middle of the road. And with the end of the year, one of our relay teams qualified for the NCAA championships, national championships at the end of the year. I was on a different relay going to that meet, but we weren't certainly expected to do anything. That relay was a good relay. They had a chance of actually placing. And about a week before the meet, the freestyler, the anchor person on that relay, got a punctured lung, which is so rare and such a crazy type of injury. And it turned out the next fastest freestyler was already on that relay team, swimming a different stroke, and the next fastest guy, just ditto. So it fell to me to sub in for him. And never been so nervous in my life, but literally I had such a big lead by the time I dove in that we ended up winning. I almost got caught by another guy, but we ended up winning, which was a fantastic experience.
So go into a little more detail. Put us in the pool with you. You see the third guy in the relay coming in. You have a really big lead. You jump off into the pool. What's going through your mind?
I was scared to death. You know, usually in a 50-yard freestyle race, I might breathe once or twice. I breathed five times. So I kept looking to see if the guy was catching me. And the whole way, and it wasn't really until the last few strokes, I'm like, we're actually going to win this thing. We won. I was very happy. It was so much relief as well, just because I didn't let those guys down.
So you guys were national champs.
We were national champs.
So when you came out of the water, what was it like?
Oh, it was just a relief, mostly. Excitement, but relief. We all were jumping around and screaming. Our coach was going crazy on the sideline. It was a very unexpected win.
Wow.
How was that a life-changing event, and how did that prepare you for what you're doing today?
Well, the fact that I got that opportunity really has, several times in life, really made me look back on it. I swam my whole life, morning practices, getting up before classes in college, swimming a lot, 20 hours a week. It was hard work, and so certainly hard work put me in the position to be on that relay. But at the same time, the fact that I was able to take that spot was really luck. I've looked at many opportunities in life. You can work hard and prepare and put yourself in the position to succeed, but at the end of the day, there is a little bit about it that's luck or fate, and sometimes that means you got to take the opportunities in front of you. So
we're going to come back to that point and apply it to the healthcare industry now. Before we go there, though, one of the things you said in the green room that you loved about the swimming was being on a team. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I have some of my closest friends developed from swimming. You spend a lot of time with people in the pool. As you get to swimming being a competitive team sport in college, you know, it's a real team. I mean, your race matters for the point score, and competition matters like that. And for me, it just it really solidified a lot of to go through that amount of training and a lot of meets on the weekends where you're spending a ton of time with an activity like that and devoting yourself to it. I think it just develops friendships that you might not otherwise get to that level of depth.
You mentioned that part of the interest in the team was keeping the team together. Fast forward us to your work at McKinsey and why you ultimately decided to run a business instead of remain a consultant.
Good question. McKinsey's a great place. I had a fantastic time there, and certainly loved the strategic aspect of the problems that we solved. A couple of the things that I felt like for me were missing is, number one, you'd make strategic recommendations to clients and they'd say thank you, and generally they would then take the recommendations and be responsible for implementing them. Now, that could be good if the recommendations weren't good, but you sort of lack the tail end of the impact of solving the problems because you're not really there to carry them out. And secondly, just working with teams, to your question, you work with some great people, and then you pick up and go to a different project and work with different great people, and then you pick up and go with different great people. And in terms of the relationships and the good working bonds that you can form, I felt like I'd love to work with a team and build the credibility and the trust and stick with them such that the team actually ends up being a really high-performing team and, you know, better than the sum of the parts. And so I always felt like in the role that I'm in now, in a role like this, both of those would be potentially more fulfilling.
You mentioned that in running a business, of course, you're now accountable for the results. That was both scary, but you also liked it. Tell us more.
Well, it's one thing to give an answer and set out a strategy. It's another thing to actually deliver against it. And I just didn't know how I'd do it at that. I remember when I joined the advisory board, one of my first projects, we'd launched a new product. It felt like the right strategic direction for the firm. I had to go out and sell it to members and talk to members about why they should participate in this program. So I was actually put in the position of not only talking about it, but actually getting people to sign up and pay for it and want to join. And I loved it. But I didn't know how it'd be at that, and before I actually went out and did it.
Yeah, it's in some ways it sounds like finding out the swimmer had a punctured lung, and now you needed to step up and take his place.
Perhaps
a similar situation to the swimming analogy occurred when you were about to give your first earnings report. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
So I stepped into the CEO role in 2008, about a week before really Lehman went out of business and the whole market turned upside down. That was a difficult time for our company, as with many other companies. we're subscription based, so maybe not as much impacted as some that had to resell their business every year. But we were facing a situation where revenues were going to be pretty flat, and we still felt like the healthcare environment was going to be an environment where our members, our hospital and health system customers, needed a lot of help. And so that year, going into 2009, we decided to continue to invest in new programs and growth versus pull back, lay off employees, and really try to manage the cost line hard. And we had to communicate that to investors, and that was my first earnings call that I did alone as CEO.
Tell us what you were feeling when you had to make that call.
Well, inside, I always felt like it was the right call. But you never know. I was new on the job, and you're predicting the future, and you don't always know. And a lot of investors don't like it when earnings go down,
really,
to put it mildly. And you know, that call was difficult. We got a lot of pushback on the call. We had one investor very angry on the call. And certainly that makes you question whether you're doing the right thing and whether that's the right step. And certainly being new in the role, you don't have the many years of track record to have the confidence that you're doing the right thing.
So when the call was over, was it similar to when the race was over, relief? or was there, you know, ecstasy? Or what was it?
You know, relief probably didn't come until you fast forward a little bit more into the present, where certainly a lot of the investments we made are paying off in terms of a lot of help we can provide to hospitals now in a rapidly changing and complex environment. So I do feel good about them now, but it took a while. We had to get through a pretty tough year in 2009, and by the end of 2009, it started to feel like things were going in the right direction, but it's more of a long-term relief once things start to pay off.
In just a few words, because we're almost out of time, what's the number one problem you'd like to be able to say you solved?
I would love to address America's cost and quality issue in healthcare. We face a real decision about how to manage the cost trajectory here that we spend on healthcare. It's really unsustainable at its current rates, yet we need to manage that in ways that keep Americans having access to very high quality care and continue to fund innovation and fund improvement in healthcare. And that's a very difficult challenge that we're facing, and we can play a big role in it.
Yeah. Would you give us the web address, please, for the advisor board company?
Very simple. www.advisory.com.
Advisory.com.
Advisory.com.
Keep it simple. Thank you. We've been speaking with Robert Musselwhite. Robert is the CEO of the advisory board company. I'd like to thank my co-hosts, David Taylor of Buchanan Ingersoll & Rooney, and David Cooper of the Bank of America, for helping me with the interview. I'd like to make sure that you visit us on the web. So don't forget to visit us on the web at www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about our executive leaders. And we will be right back in just a moment after this important business spotlight. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and this is your Business Spotlight. Today's guest is
Steve Ovie at Battlefield Telecom Consulting.
You beat me to the punch, Steve. What is Battlefield Telecom Consulting?
I've been in business for a while, and what I'm working with is helping customers cut their telecom-related expenses and improve their bottom line.
How do you do that?
I act as their agent with the carriers. For example, if your organization is spending $2,000 a month or more on telecom-related expenses, be it voice, data, or cellular, I'll go in and negotiate with the carriers on your behalf to cut those expenses.
And why do the carriers listen to you?
Because I'm talking for the customer. And with all of the competition that's going on in the market these days between all the providers, for example, the cable companies and the carriers and the like, they're trying to keep market share.
Yeah. Do you have an interesting success story you can share with us, Steve?
Oh, God, I've got a million of them. But one of the best ones is, just to give you a typical idea, a local retailer here in the D.C. area had done some downsizing within the last decade or so, but had never looked at their telecom-related expenses, thinking they were fixed costs like many CFOs do. Mm-hmm. We were able to find 50% savings. They were even able to stay with their same carrier, and we were also able to get a PBX vendor in to show them how they could cut costs on their internal equipment.
Is that an unusual success story, or is that somewhat typical of the kind of savings you can provide?
That's typical. I can find savings 70% of the time. 90% of the time, I can keep you with your same vendor.
Thanks very much, Steve. We've been speaking with Steve Oviatt of Battlefield Telecom Consulting. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and that was your Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions. And I'm joined by my co-hosts, David Taylor of Buchanan Ingersoll & Rooney, and David Cooper of the Bank of America. And I'd like to introduce to you our next guest. This is John Castellani. John is the president and CEO of Pharma. Welcome, John.
Thank you.
And what is Pharma?
Well, Pharma, the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, are America and the world's largest biopharmaceutical companies that do the research and develop and bring to patients the medicines, the life-saving, life-enhancing medicines that we're all familiar with.
And you do what on behalf of all of these companies?
We represent those companies, which employ about 700,000 people directly here in the United States and about 4 million indirectly. We represent them in front of the government at the state level, at the federal level, internationally, around the world, that do the policies and the regulations that affect our ability to develop those medicines.
The benefit to us as average citizens of your work is what?
If we can get the policies right in terms of what are the intellectual property protections, what are the valuation policies, what's the regulatory process, then we can bring, our scientists can bring life-saving medicines to people, to patients.
Now, the companies and medicines that you've brought to market is just like a who's who. Can you give us just a couple examples?
I'll give you an example of two. One of the newest, which is a very, very vital, Herceptin, which is one of the first anti-cancer drugs that is targeted for specific genetic makeup of women who get breast cancer. So it's much more effective because it's much more targeted. And then, of course, probably the largest selling prescription medicine in the history of medicines, and that's Lipitor, which helps people control their statins and control their cholesterol and avoid heart attacks and strokes and other maladies that come from high cholesterol.
How much R&D takes place every single year?
In the industry in 2010 did $67.5 billion worth of research and development, and our companies did about $50 billion of that.
Wow. So you're doing almost all of the heavy lifting.
Most of the heavy lifting.
Fantastic.
That's right.
The company has been around, or the organization, excuse me, has been around for how long?
It's about 70 years old.
And you have been the president CEO for how long?
13 months.
So you're relatively new.
I am new.
Okay, so why did they absolutely positively had to have you?
Well, if you had to look at something that I brought to the job, it is because of my background. I have been both in business and in this business of influencing public policy. So I know what goes on in the halls of Congress, in state legislators, in regulators, and in governments around the world, and I know what goes on in the C-suites of very large companies. I'm able to translate between the two for each of the two.
Yeah, now, so that's why they picked you. Why did you pick them?
The challenge, really the challenge. The industry right now stands at a crossroads of what its future will be based on a lot of public policy decisions that are being made over the next several months, over the next several years. It really will define this industry going forward and what we can do for patients.
You said that you bore easily. What did you mean by that?
Well, I like to be challenged. I like something that requires a lot of intensive focus of my mind, of my energy, my activities. I like something that the answers aren't in front of you, that you have to go out and find them. You have to be creative. You have to think of it in the context of what can you do differently, what needs to be changed, what needs to be ripped apart. You know, I've held positions. I was president of the Business Roundtable for 9 years. It was great. The organization was doing just fine. And, you know, you should always leave those kinds of things the day before you should, not the day after.
So were you a very curious only child growing up, John?
Oh, no. Yeah, I was. I had to share my only childhood with 8 brothers and sisters. I grew up in a mob.
And what was that like?
It was wonderful. It was terrific. It was loud. It was full of action. It was full of argument, full of activity. My parents were Italian immigrants. They were teachers. My dad had to have 4 jobs to feed us all, clothe us all, get us all to school, and it was great fun.
Now, when you say your dad had 4 jobs, your dad actually was an entrepreneur, was he not?
Well, in some of those jobs, we lived on a farm. So we operated a small farm in upstate New York. He was a teacher at a school system and then ultimately a school administrator. We owned a small resort in the Adirondacks. We operated that. And then he used to buy, refurbish apartment houses, and then we'd either sell them or rent them.
It sounds to me like your dad bored easily as well. The apple didn't fall far from the tree.
He's 95 years old, still going strong. Wow. So he's always stayed very active.
And you worked with your dad growing up.
Sure.
What was that like?
Great fun. You learned a lot. It was terrific. He had a marvelous curiosity about things and about people that he tried to impart to his children. Still does. And it was just fun to be with him. In fact, the trick was, how did you get to be with him alone?
One of the things that you tell us he required of you was this satisfying of curiosity. Can you tell us more about that?
Sure. My dad and my mom, who was not a passive passive influence in the family, required that all of their children read a book a week, four books a month. Two they picked, my dad picked, and two you could pick. And so you had to read, you read constantly, and it was something that was instilled into everybody in the family, and something goes on to this day.
What was your favorite book growing up, the favorite book that you got to pick?
The one I got to pick was The Microbe Hunters.
The Microbe Hunters?
The Microbe Hunters. It actually got me interested in biology and chemistry, which are the fields I pursued in college.
John, you mentioned in the interview that there was a saying that your dad kind of suggested that might work for you, and it may have led to your extroversion and some of the things you're doing now.
Well, the saying actually was something that he talked about and also something that he did, and he said that you should approach everybody in the world as if you could learn something from them. And so no matter whether you were talking to the most famous scientist you've ever met or the fellow that came around and collected the garbage, you could always learn something from them that would be important for you to know in the future. And he encouraged us to learn from everybody with whom we interacted.
How did your dad live that out?
He did that. He was very gregarious, is still very gregarious, very art-going, loves to engage in conversation, to learn what people are doing, why they're doing it, what motivates them, and to try to see things from their perspective.
Is your dad 95 and still going strong simply because of good genes, or is there something else? Does he have a secret? Maybe you've already covered it.
Well, I hope it's genes, because if it's a secret, I don't know it. You know, it's good health care. This is a man who, you know, was an immigrant, came to the United States as a very, very young, as a young child, 8 years old, was the first in his family, as all of his siblings did, to go to college, which was unheard of.
Wow.
Went to college, ended up in the United States Army, landed at Omaha Beach at age 20. Wow. So he was one of the first people in the first division to land at Omaha Beach. And obviously the experience of World War II ending in Germany when the war ended. And somebody who never talked about it, but it was somebody who learned from every experience that he had and had to learn from every experience because it was all new to him.
Yeah. What was the favorite book that your dad gave you?
I love Michener.
And so you were reading James Michener at how old?
As soon as we could read. Now, we started with the 500 Hats of Bartholomew Cubbins and all of, you know, Dr.
Yes.
Seuss, but
yes.
you were reading it by the time you were 11 years
old. Wow.
You mentioned also that in a prior life, when you were working on TRW, you lost a very close friend and co-worker, and that influenced your life as well.
Well, it's one of those learning moments that nobody ever wants to have. I was at TRW running their government operations and was recruited along with four other executives who came from outside of Tenneco when Tenneco was really on the precipice of bankruptcy. It was losing a lot of money. It was one of these diversified companies that was extremely diverse in its business structure and its businesses that it operated in. The leader that the board recruited was Mike Walsh. Mike came from being the CEO of Union Pacific Railroad. We got to an environment where Fortune magazine referred to it as red alert going next to purple alert. Literally, how do you keep the company alive and save it? A few months into that very, very intense process, Mike was diagnosed with a brain tumor. A few months after that, he died. So both the loss of a friend and the loss of a leader during a transition which was intensively focusing, required intensive focus of your mind and your energies, was a learning experience I hope I never have again. But the ability to, you know, as they say in the cockpit of an airline, somebody fly the airplane while somebody is dealing with the problem, was a learning experience that it was incredibly valuable but came in at a horrible, horrible cost.
How'd you do it?
You know, you focused on the fact that you had to make decisions irrespective of what you felt personally at that time. You focused on, you went back to understand what your strategic purpose was and what your objective was, and that you weren't going to question it. You weren't going to relitigate it. You had picked the lane, the board had picked the lane you were going to go in, you focused on the fact that nobody had written rules for this beforehand, and so everything had to be questioned. A lot of things had to be changed, and you had to be adaptive, and you had to accept change as a normal course of life. And so the level of intensity, the level of creativity, the level of focus really rose above anything that I'd had ever experienced wow. before in my life. And you learn that you can manage through yeah. that if you're accepting of the need to change, the need to focus, the need to be creative, and the need to accept outside ideas.
Yeah. You've done very well for yourself. What does your dad think?
My dad keeps a picture of my college ID in 1968 where I had hair down to my shoulders and I was sitting out in front of the General Electric Company main plant in Schenectady, New York with a placard saying something about the war in Vietnam.
Does he still give you books to read?
And he laughs. Yes, he does. And he laughs at it, but I think he's proud. I hope he is.
Would you give us the web address for Pharma, please?
Sure. John? It is www.pharma.org.
Okay. One more time. I want to make sure everybody gets it.
Pharma.org.
Thanks very much. We've been speaking with John Castellani. John is the president and CEO of Pharma.org. I'd like to thank my two co-hosts, David Taylor of Buchanan, Ingersoll & Rooney, and David Cooper of the Bank of America. Don't forget to visit us on the web at www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about our executive leaders. And we will be right back in just a moment after this important business spotlight.
This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage International, and this is your business spotlight. Joining us today is
Sophie Pyle.
And Sophie, who are you with?
I'm with Vox Worldwide.
What is Vox Worldwide?
Vox Worldwide is my company. I do social media maintenance for a variety of different clients.
Social media maintenance. What the heck is that?
Yes. So maybe a company doesn't want to have their marketing person working full-time on their Facebook and Twitter accounts, which are very important today, that every business have one. So what I do is I maintain their Facebook and Twitter accounts and also try to optimize other tools so that they are getting the most out of today's social media programs.
How long have you been in business?
I've been in business since I graduated college in 2009, and it's been booming. People love the internet.
You started a business right out of college?
Yes.
How's it going?
It's going well. It took a lot of struggles in the beginning, but I learned a lot. It's hard having your own business.
Is there a particular success story you can reference?
Yes. My biggest client acquisition yet so far has been guestofaguest.com, which is owned by Cameron Winklevoss of the famous Winklevoss twins, and Rochelle. She's a wonderful boss up in New York is where it's grounded, but I'll be doing a lot of coverage of Fashion's Night Out tonight in Georgetown, so I'm really excited about that.
Mm-hmm. Why should companies be considering social media as a part of their strategy?
It's another excellent marketing tool that's relatively inexpensive. It can be free if you have the right tools and the right things in place, so something that every business should have.
Uh-huh. And if someone wanted to get a hold of you, how could they reach you?
They can reach me at Vox Worldwide, VOXWorldwide.com.
Great. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage, and this is we've been speaking with Sophie Pyle, who's the CEO of Vox Worldwide, and this has been your Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you are listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and I am joined by my two co-hosts, both named David. David Taylor of Buchanan, Ingersoll & Rooney, and David Cooper of the Bank of America. And we are pleased to introduce to you our next guest, Margaret Broad. Margaret is the head of school at St. Margaret's School. So welcome, Margaret, and what is St. Margaret's School?
Thank you. I'm happy to be here. St. Margaret's School is a girls' boarding and day school on the Rappahannock River. We're about halfway down the river. The river's a mile wide where we are. And we are a small school with a global reach and a big mission.
So global reach means what?
Global reach means we have girls from 13 countries and 10 states, and we are a very deliberately diverse school. We've built the school that way so that the girls, the Americans particularly, have an experience outside of their own culture without ever having to leave the United States.
Wow. And in addition to what you just mentioned, there's something else that's special about this school. What is it?
As a small school, just between 140 and 150 girls, we know every single girl. And our mission is to help each girl recognize her potential, her strengths, her challenges, her beliefs, and to give her the spiritual and emotional foundation to lead the rest of her life. Each one is being challenged to look at every aspect of her life. A lot of schools talk about having a holistic mission, but we give time to that.
Wow. I mean, just hearing the conviction in your voice, I believe you. How long has the school been around?
St. Margaret's was founded in 1921.
Okay. Now, you have been at the school for how long?
30 years.
And the last 22 of which as head of school.
That's right.
Okay. So I'm going to ask you the same question I asked you in the green room. Why have you poured your life into these girls?
I passionately believe in the mission of St. Margaret's School. I believe in the importance of having a great education, but also discovering so many other things about yourself before you turn 18. Because I believe for a girl, that offers all kinds of opportunities the rest of your life.
Yep.
I have to say, one of the reasons that I have done this is because I had a fantastic public school education, an academic education, but so many other things you don't have in a public high school. And public high schools are great, but there's so many other things you don't have if you're in a community that doesn't ask you to go too far beyond academics.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned in the green room that you never intended to pour your life into this school and these girls. What did you mean by that?
My life was headed in a completely different direction. I worked in computer systems. Then my son was born. I was a stay-at-home mom. I wanted to be a teacher. I knew I wanted to be a teacher. That's a great profession to be in if you have a family. And my husband and I lived in England, and we were in our early 30s, and we said to ourselves, is this all there is? Lovely home, nice boat, 100 rose bushes, but surely we want to do more with our lives.
Okay, we're going to come back to that. That's a great point to come back to. Where does your story starts in the Chicago suburbs, does it not?
That's right. I grew up in the Chicago suburbs. My father was a World War II pilot. He went to Northwestern to get his MBA, and then he stayed on and worked for Interlake Steel for his whole career.
And he loved to play some games with you, did he not?
He did.
Tell us about that.
We played math games and card games endlessly. My father was a quiet man. He had a lot of patience, but I think he could see the curiosity in my mind, and we spent a lot of time doing math problems.
And what did that do for you?
I found it exciting. I found it interesting. It gave me a connection with a man I would not have had a connection with otherwise, because he was very absorbed in his career. But it allowed me to be part of his life in a way that I hadn't been able to be part of his life before.
That's beautiful.
And there was another intellectual pursuit that you enjoyed. What was that?
French. I started French when I was in the seventh grade and quickly discovered a completely different world in the French language. And I thought that was fascinating, too. So two languages, French and math.
They sound very different, but you told us that they're not different at all. Please explain that.
I don't believe they are different. So many people who have an aptitude for one have an aptitude for the other. They're both logic systems. They're both very orderly. This doesn't just go for French. It goes for most languages. So if you think in mathematical terms, you have to follow sequences. You have to learn the order of operations. If you think in a foreign language, you have to do the same things.
What tilted you toward French and away from mathematics?
Those dreadful experiences in the classroom. In my high school classroom, I was one of two girls in the calculus advanced placement class. I sat right in the front, and the teacher looked over me and called on the young man at the back. And when I went to college, I had exactly the same experience. And I ended up my first semester of college. I had intended to be a math major. I wanted to be a math teacher. I ended my first semester of college and said, I'm not going to do this, and went to French.
When you first started working at Time Life in Computer Sciences, you were lured away from there by a lovely man who later became your husband. But more importantly, I think you said you had life experience, which probably molded you in your experiences with the school in terms of wanting to do broader things.
When I was in college, I went to France for the first time. I'd been studying French forever, and it was my first experience of being outside of the United States and realizing that there were so many more choices I could have made in my life and so many more things I wanted to know about. And it kindled in me a curiosity.
In fact, in the green room, you said, I wish I'd known this before. What would you have done differently if you would have known it before?
I think it has more to do with how I believe education should be than what I would have done before. I would, for myself, I wished I had had a broader experience because I think I would have made different choices of activities. I probably would have been a bigger risk taker as a young person, and some of those risks might have gotten me places it took me a while to get.
Well, what's one place where you eventually got to that you are really happy you got to, and it was kind of a risk?
My current position as a head of school was a big risk.
How so?
I started at St. Margaret's as a teacher. I never expected to be other than a teacher. I loved my job.
How is it you became a teacher?
My husband and I moved from England. We came to the United States without jobs to restore a home for my family in the bottom of the northern neck of Virginia. We had great education. We had great work experience. We thought we'd be able to get a job. We could not get a job. We have one of those strange stories that my family refers to as the Great American Story. We'd been in the United States for 3 months, and suddenly we had two houses, two jobs, and two cars because my cousin was walking on the beach with the head of St. Margaret's School in August, and she said, "Oh, my goodness, my French teacher has moved away. I need a French teacher." And my cousin turned to her and said, "My cousin's a French teacher." 2 days later, I went for an interview, and I sat down in the head's office in a beautiful building, and we looked at each other, and she asked me about my family, and we discovered that her sister and my mother had gone to school together at St. Catherine's School in Richmond. And those of you who know Virginia know that if you can make a family connection, you've made the connection.
Right. Yes. You said you never intended to pour your life into these girls, but you have. At what point or what event was it where you finally realized, I'm going to pour my life into these girls?
I'd been at St. Margaret's for 9 years. The venerable, much respected head of school had retired. She'd been there for 34 years. She hired me. And there'd been a man serving as head of school for 5 years. The chair of the board came to me and said, "The man will be leaving at the end of next year. Would you be willing to be a candidate for head of school?" It is not something I had ever thought of.
Really?
I was a very happy mother of a 12-year-old, and I really hadn't thought about taking that serious a position that would commit me to a really full-time job away from my family. Not away from my family, but enormously more demanding than the job of a 10-month classroom teacher.
Why'd you do it?
I passionately believed in the mission of the school. Passionately. When I stepped onto the campus of St. Margaret's for the very first time, on the first day that the students were there, the experience for me was one of coming home. I felt completely at home in a women's environment, in a girls' school where girls were valued and they spoke my language.
You told us earlier that the changes in the school's curriculum and the diversity came after you became head. Could you explain a little bit about that?
When I became head of St. Margaret's, we were a traditional girls' southern boarding school, everyone from very similar backgrounds, two or three states. I believed that we needed a bigger picture and that our girls needed more opportunities. So we started an international program for the benefit of American students 17 years ago, and we developed a program that is multifaceted so that cross-cultural understanding is embedded within the program. Girls share living space, activity space, classroom space, advisor space with girls from other countries. And by being with someone from another country, you're challenged to understand yourself. Whereas if you're in an environment where everybody is exactly like you, you are not challenged to think about who you are, what you believe in, and why you believe that. I didn't get that growing up in the Midwest, where everybody was pretty much the same in my high school.
But you're giving it to these girls now.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Would you give us the web address, please, for St. Margaret's School?
www.sms.org.
Couldn't be any easier.
Couldn't
than
be
that.
Any easier. No.
We have been speaking with Margaret Broad. Margaret is the head of school at St. Margaret's School. I'd like to thank my co-hosts, David Taylor of Buchanan Ingersoll & Rooney and David Cooper of the Bank of America, for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit us on the web at www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about our executive leaders, and we will be right back in just a moment after this important business spotlight. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and this is your business spotlight. Today's guest is
Lynette Spano.
And Lynette, who are you with?
I'm with SCI Consulting.
But you're not here to talk about SCI today, are you?
No, I'm not. Talk about the new face of America.
And what is or who is the new face of America?
Well, it's a show that it's in a pilot stage right now, and we're marketing the pilot. It is it's a platform to host, for me to be the host, to talk about subjects and various different topics that affect modern-day Americans that include Hispanics.
So the new face of America is you, but it's also a people group, isn't that right?
Absolutely. There are 50 million Hispanics, documented Hispanics in the United States, and undocumented, we think there might be another 10 million. So it's imperative that there is a platform where from the experience of a Hispanic perspective that there can be, you know, the stories can be told about the accomplishments, the contributions that Hispanics and Latinos have made here in the United States.
Why is now the right time for this show?
The right time is now because contemporary Latino immigrants came in here in 1985 and 1989. Their children today are 20, 25, and 30 years old, and they all, their language is English, and so they all need a forum, a medium where they can tap into that is spoken again from the Hispanic experience.
Is there a business aspect to this? Is there market power behind this group?
Oh, absolutely. The purchasing power for Latinos in the United States are, they're talking $8 billion in purchasing power. The networks and the broadcasting networks are beginning to realize that it's a market that they've got to pay attention to.
Fantastic. We've been speaking with Lynette Spano of SCI Consulting. She's the founder and CEO, but she's also the new face of America.
Absolutely.
This has been Mike Mannion, your host with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and that was your business spotlight. We are back, and you are listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and I'm joined by my co-hosts, David Taylor of Buchanan, Ingersoll & Rooney, and David Cooper of the Bank of America. And we'd like to welcome our final guest of the day. His name is Jim Bellis. Jim is the CEO and chairman of Diplomatic Language Services. Jim, welcome. And tell us, what is Diplomatic Language Services?
No, thank you. And Diplomatic Language Services is a language training and testing company. And we also develop materials. And our customer is largely the federal government, the military, the intelligence community, and the civilian agencies, Foreign Agricultural Service.
Now,
Department.
Why would those folks come to you rather than Rosetta Stone, for instance?
Well, they come to us because they have a mission to work with foreign nationals and be able to communicate at some level appropriate for their jobs. Some need to be very conversant and have high capabilities. Some need just to have familiarization. And what we provide them are two things, not just the language training, but also by virtue of working with a foreign national who's born native to that language, educated, and has taught, they're able to teach not just the language, the vocabulary, but also be able to teach the culture and the idioms and the colloquialisms and how it would be said in that country.
Can you give us an example of the nuance of that?
Well, if you were to go to a country, a one word that we would use here, you would express it as a thought. There they would express it as a feeling. And so you would have a different vocabulary. And you might have the literal word that say, I don't want to break myself, but what you really meant to say in that other language is, I didn't want to hurt myself. And so the word break might translate, might be there for the definition. The important part of the language training that happens is it's an intense process of very difficult work. You're there for 4 hours a day. If you're learning the language from zero,
yeah,
you'd be there for 4 hours a day. You would study outside of the classroom 2 hours a day. And these folks come in order to arrive at some level of competency in a relatively short period of time, sometimes 3 to 6 months, and in some cases, if they're going for higher levels, as much as a year. To expect an individual to take a computer program and do that assumes two things. One, that they have that aptitude and discipline, and that they have something that really works. And much of what's out there right now that you can buy out of a kiosk does not do any of that.
Wow.
That they do not do that level of intensity, and they can't substitute for the interchange of a human. That was one of the reasons I bought the business, was it was not going to be disintermediated by technology.
And we're going to get to why you bought the business shortly. Something else about the way you go about training, though. You said something to the effect of, we make it a point not to be too curious.
Oh, well.
What does that mean?
A number of the people that we train have a security concern, and they work for an agency that does intelligence, and they show up as individuals, and they don't tell us which agency they're from. They pay with their personal credit card. But we know that they must be, because they're committing 6 months of their life and a $60,000 payment on their credit card. You know that this is not just a guy who's taking it up as a hobby. But you learn not to ask a lot of questions of where you're going to be stationed and where do you work.
Yes. You bought this company when it was in bankruptcy. Why did you do that?
Well, I originally didn't set out to buy a company in bankruptcy, but I was looking for a business that wouldn't be disintermediated by technology.
And that means what? If you could just explain what that means, that would be helpful.
For 30 years, I was a retailer. And then when I finished with that business and sold it and moved on to other things, for the next 6 years, I did 30 things in consulting. And over the course of all those jobs, all those engagements, I would notice again and again companies that were just fine, except that what they were doing had now moved on, that the technology had moved on, a new investment was necessary, but they were already well heavily invested and entrenched in some old technology. I did not want to get into that kind of a business. The second is that I'm not a technology guy. I'm more of a people and process guy.
Mm-hmm.
And so me pretending to be expert capable in an area of technology was not where I was going to win. And as I looked for businesses, one that I was shown that was for sale and was doing fine was in the language business. And as I dug into it, I discovered that a lot of people had spent millions of dollars trying to have software replace an instructor and fail. And so as we tried to buy that business, I became increasingly convinced that was the right business. The second element was that the government was quite enlightened, including the military, very enlightened about teaching languages to their soldiers, to their employees going overseas. They wanted them to be able to communicate, not just shoot a gun or be a bureaucrat.
Right. Let's go back to the very beginning. What does it mean, and what was it like to be the, quote, anointed one?
The anointed one?
That's what you referred to yourself as in the green room.
I guess this comes out of being born into a European family where the firstborn is automatically treasured and held as valuable.
Yeah.
And so and that's a benefit that you get. It makes you gives you some self-confidence that some people in general like you. And I normally assume that I'm going to be liked as opposed to hated.
Tell us about growing up.
The context, and we talked about it, was what was it that that formed me, or what significant events in my life. And I was born in Italy of an Italian mom. My parents had met after World War II. My dad was part of the occupying force. My mom was working in the military office there. They saw each other, fell in love, and then a year later I come along. And he gets stationed in Greece. I stay with my mom in Italy. So I'm raised by my mom and her mom and a cadre of other relatives that are there. I learn Italian. And then we move together, my mom and I, to Greece, where my dad is stationed. And we live there for two or three years, and I learn Greek. So I now speak Greek and Italian. I'm translating Greek or into Greek for my mom, because I'm learning Greek faster than she is. And then we move to Texas. And Texas is a whole different scene, and that's where I learned to speak English.
Now, given what you just said, I can see perhaps the tie to diplomatic language services.
That would be logical, but no. Diplomatic language services and anything that I've done is I have an interest in curiosity and affection for just about every product that I've ever worked with.
Except for being a lawyer.
Well, yeah, that comes later. But let me go ahead and finish that point. And that is that I've never have been the expert in any product that I've worked in or any company that I've worked in. When I got into the bicycle business, I was not there because I was passionate about cycling or passionate about working on bicycles. I learned through that process that what I'm passionate about is customers, employees, businesses, the game of business, making things work, breaking things and fixing them again. That's what I'm passionate about. And the environment that it then creates is I have a space where these people who are experts can shine, because I don't get in their way. I'm not second-guessing them. Everybody has been smarter at the things that I've worked at than I have. In fact, most of the people that work at the things that I work at are smarter than I am.
Yeah. I'd like to talk about your law, your
Well, as the Anointed One, and also I was it was to be that I was going to move the generation along. Nobody in my family had gotten a college degree. My mom was a teacher, but even hers was a teaching degree, and so it was clear and just understood that I would get a college degree, and that my parents would really have liked to see me be a lawyer. And so in junior high school, when you write your paper, what are you going to be when you grow up? That's what I wrote it about. And all of my high school, I was going to be a lawyer. As I went into college, I took history and speech. I was going to be a lawyer. When I graduated, I had, you know, on my certificate, I had a BA and pre-law. And I got married directly after college, did my six-month reserve duty rather than going to Canada or Vietnam. And then when it came time to start thinking about college or law school, my wife said, well, why don't you work for a couple of years, make some money, then you won't have to work while you're in law school. And during that time, I went to work. I went on 23 interviews. The 23rd one finally got me a job as a manager of a bike shop. And I told the guy I'd be there for 2 years, and then I was going to leave. And he thought that was fine. And about a year and a half into it, I saw a movie where the guy says, the lead actor, says, I'll have my attorney draw up the papers and get them over to you in the morning. And it was in that moment I realized I didn't want to be the paper drawer upper. I wanted to be the guy cutting the deal, the guy making things happen. And so my wife went back to school. I stayed with that business. And 6 or 7 years later, I had a customer who blew up my excuses about why I didn't do my own, since the guy I was working for had no interest in me buying into his company. Yeah. And I opened my own and haven't looked back.
Wow. Is this your life's work now, Diplomatic Language Services, or will there be other problems you'll solve and things you'll create?
Great segue. Now, my son has stepped up to president in August, and he got intro to the job by virtue of being my son. But he just came aboard to help me out as we turned the company around. He's extremely bright, hardworking, and over a period of about a year and a half, it kind of drifted into he became more integrated and more integral to the business, until finally, as I looked around, I said, geez, you're doing more and better than I am. You need to step up to president. And he, with a little bit of reluctance initially, but now with great zeal, has done a terrific job of doing things. He would be a perfect counterpart to me in the way that he does things with such care and pre-thinking and then follow through. And it's left me free to do the things that I do really well, which is to be with customers, to be with the employees, to think more strategically, and to make sure that he has the resources to do the fabulous job that he's doing.
Yeah, congratulations. Would you give us the web address for Diplomatic Language Services?
Sure. It's www.dlsdc.com. That's Diplomatic Language Services, District of Columbia.com.
DLSDC.com.
Perfect.
DLSDC.com.
Perfect.
Perfect. We've been speaking with Jim Bellis, CEO and Chairman of Diplomatic Language Services. I'd like to thank all of our guests today, including Robert Musselwhite, CEO of the Advisory Board Company, John Castellani, President and CEO of Pharma, Margaret Broad, Head of School at St. Margaret's School, and, of course, most recently, Jim Bellis. Jim is the CEO and Chairman of Diplomatic Language Services. I'd like to thank my two co-hosts, David Taylor of Buchanan, Ingersoll & Rooney, and David Cooper of the Bank of America, for helping me with the interviews. More than anyone else, I'd like to thank you, our listening audience. If it wasn't for you, we wouldn't even have a radio show. So thank you very much for listening. We have been broadcasting from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce, so thank you, folks, from the Chamber. And don't forget to visit us on the web at www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about our executive leaders. This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions. Again, thank you so much for listening, and we will see you next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on Federal News Radio. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on Federal News Radio. That's executiveleadersradio.com.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source
this
for federal
news. This paid commercial
news.
May not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated.